At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the premiere episode of our new podcast, True Crime All the Time Unsolved. I'm your host, Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you today?
I'm great, man.
It's always good. It's a good day. Now, I know a lot of you listeners will be coming over from our popular true crime podcast, True Crime All the Time. You know, we started this new one, Unsolved, as almost what you would call a spinoff to focus on unsolved crimes. But for those of you that are joining us for the first time, welcome. We appreciate it. As always, we talk about it in our other podcast. Visit our website at truecrimeallthetime.com. You'll find all of our contact information there. We're using that site for both podcasts. So I'll probably say that for the first few podcasts just to make sure everybody knows. So while you're out at the website, definitely click on the Patreon button. That will take you to our Patreon page. You can help support the show for as little as $2 a month. Gibby and I have been trying to add new content to the Patreon page, definitely at least weekly at a minimum. And then one last announcement is I finally placed an order for some True Crime All the Time merchandise. So that's going to be here pretty soon, and I'll definitely let everybody know on both of the podcasts when that comes in.
I'm still working on Gibbyware.
Gibbyware will maybe be a thing.
Right. It will be.
But to start, you know, we've got some coffee mugs, mouse pads, and I'm going to have a store set up. So I'll let everybody know when that stuff is in. So Gibby, we have a very special guest with us today.
I'm excited.
On Skype, and I think it's about time that we introduce her. Her name is Jennifer LeCornu Carreri.
Yeah.
Do you want to go Jennifer or Jenny?
Jenny.
Jenny. Okay. So we'll say Jenny. So Jenny, how are you today?
Very good. Thank you.
So a little background. Jenny and I met through Twitter, and this was right around the time that Gibby and I started talking about doing this spinoff podcast, True Crime All the Time Unsolved. Jenny's story, it caught me somehow. And if you look at her Twitter picture, I guess that's what got me, Jenny. I mean, right from the start, your Twitter picture, which is basically you and your identical twin sister.
Yes.
With, it's almost like a break down the middle.
Correct. Yes. That was I did the show Crime Watch Daily. Okay. And that was actually a screenshot from the show that they had done. Yes. It's a crack down the middle in between us.
And that there was something about that picture that just grabbed me. You know, I explained to Jenny what we were doing with the new podcast. You know, Gibby and I both researched her sister's case, and unbelievably, thankfully, she agreed to be on our first podcast.
Yes. So
here we are.
I was very excited about it.
Well, believe me, we're excited to have you. I mean, this case, let's talk a little bit about the case. We'll do a synopsis to start. Okay. So your sister, Jody, whose real name is Joanne, but she went by Jody, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Jody LeCornu.
Yes.
Was murdered on March 2nd, 1996.
My wedding anniversary. Yes, it was my parents' wedding anniversary.
Oh, I did not know that. You have basically spent the last 21 or so years, I mean, number one, searching for the killer, obviously, because this case is unsolved.
Yes.
And number two, or 1A, you know, fighting for justice for Jody through a series of legal means. I guess I'll put it that way. I'll set it up that way.
Legal means actually starting this year when I found out about her case being mishandled. It took a while.
Oh, I didn't realize it took that long.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's something we'll definitely want to get into. But I want to start out by talking about Jody. It's something that we do we try to do on our episodes is really talk about the life of the victim and personalize them so that, you know, the listeners really have an understanding of the person and the case that we're talking about. So Jenny, could you share, you know, whatever you wanted to about Jody's background and childhood, which obviously would mirror yours as identical twin sisters.
Okay. So we were one of four girls, Jody and I, two older sisters. They were a bit older than us, 7 and 9 years older. And my father was in the military. So we traveled a bit on the East Coast, most of our life in Annapolis. He was a lawyer in the Marines. So we were actually stationed at the Naval Academy when we were younger. So Jody and I were inseparable just growing up. We always had the same room, same friends, same classes. We were always together. And like I said, we spent most of our life in Annapolis. My dad actually retired from he was in the Marines, 26 years, colonel in the Marines, and went with the state's attorney's office. He actually spent his second career as a prosecutor for violent crime. I don't know if you knew that.
We didn't know that. And that's, he was in that line of work when the crime occurred, or he went in?
Correct.
Oh my gosh.
It was actually a theory that they looked at as well, even though he was in another county. They looked at it with him prosecuting. He prosecuted violent crime and drugs.
So as retaliation is what you're saying was looked at.
So, yeah. So we grew up in Annapolis, went to high school there. And, you know, we just, yeah, it was a, we had a very nice childhood growing up. And, you know, like I said, we spent all our time together.
Well, one of the pictures that I saw was the two of you in what appeared to be maybe like a school outfit.
Yes. We went to St. Mary's in Annapolis. Yes. So
it was almost like a green plaid skirts and like a button down long sleeve shirt.
We were actually, we weren't Catholic. We were one of the few families there that was not Catholic. My Jody and I had some problems growing up. We ended up, we were in the public school when we were young. I'll start with how all the drinking started with my sister and I and the drugs. My father, we actually put him in rehab when we were young. We had a family intervention. Jody and I were in sixth grade. Unfortunately, he struggled with alcohol and depression and pills. And he was a brilliant man. You know, he was lawyer, colonel in the Marines, but, you know, he suffered with these problems that happened when we were young. And ironically, not long after that, when Jody and I were in middle school, we started drinking and, he was actually drinking again. So our first drink was his vodka. And so that's sort of how our path started. As you'll hear in the story, her drinking was a bit out of hand as she got older. My parents were concerned. So that's why they put us in St. Mary's, the private school. They thought that would help keep us straight, if that makes sense.
So did it?
No.
No, it didn't.
No, it did not. It was actually... We grew up very fast and kind of this fast paced life.
So let me say this. It's amazing that you're willing to be so open, because there's so many people that struggle with these same types of problems. I think it's important for the listeners to know, because I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there struggling with those same problems right now. And we all didn't grow up with the Leave It to Beaver. I mean, you had a great family. I'm not saying that.
Correct. But correct.
A lot of us went down different paths, or you know, we went down the bad path for a period of time.
Absolutely, we did.
I appreciate you saying that, because I've spent a lot of my life, I mean, definitely when we were young, with my sister and I getting in trouble and my father being in rehab, we were definitely in a small town that we were the family with all eyes upon. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, I was, I want to say, I sort of hid my life for so long. I mean, we both struggled with eating disorders and, you know, there was a lot of things going on. And as I've gotten to the point in my life that I'm not embarrassed about it anymore, and I want to talk about it, and if I can help people. I actually moved away. We weren't living together when she died, because I had decided I was going to move away and just separate and try to get my life. We were both in rehab together. We both ran away. We both got brought back. And well, I guess we'll get to that point. But
it's important. I mean, that information is important. And the fact that you're willing to share it is important, because my perspective, and Gibby, you and I have talked about this on our other podcast a lot, when we've had victims that have had that have done things that in their past that didn't mean they didn't deserve what happened to them.
Right. Right.
That, and people know, listening in the audience, that everybody has these foibles, and it doesn't, it didn't mean that she should have ever had what happened.
Right. I mean, no doubt about it. I've got skeletons in my closet, if you want to call them skeletons.
Yeah,
right?
We all do.
Yeah. I mean, there's things that during my childhood, adulthood, right?
I think it's what makes us human, right? We're absolutely not robots. Right. You know, we've made mistakes, but that it humanizes Jody, I think, to the point where people will, especially people listening, they'll understand. I mean, she was going through things. You were going through things.
Yeah. Right. I mean, she just wasn't this beautiful girl.
Yes.
I mean, she was stunning, but she was more, you know, she had other things going on. She had, if you just look at the facade, you would never imagine I would take, right?
Not from the pictures.
Not from the pictures, right? Yes. But to know that, you know, she had her own internal struggles as well as you did.
Yeah, and Jenny, it's important to the case, right? So I think it's important to set up. Unless there was anything else that you wanted to say about background or anything before we get in the case.
But from what I understand, she was a great sister.
I mean, she was very, just a kind, wonderful, loving, just enjoyed life, you know, even though she struggled. I mean, it was just heartbreaking to see. When we were both in it growing, you know, this sort of lasted all, I mean, it did, it lasted all of our high school years. And my parents did a lot of things to try to help us, and, you know, psychiatrists and group, you know, my dad would send us, with him being at the state's attorney's office, there was lots of programs for children, lack of a better word.
At like, risk. Maybe children. Today they would call it at risk.
Children. So they would send us up places and take us, my dad would take us to the 12-step meetings with him. And, you know, because he was struggling as well. You know what I mean? So it was like all of us struggling at that point.
And that makes it very, very interesting dynamic as we jump into this case. So I think we've got to get to March 2nd, 1996. So Jenny, I don't know if you want to walk us through that.
Yes. Okay. So what happened was, so I had moved out. I had made my way. Actually, my parents had, I'll just start back a little bit why we weren't together, because we were always together, but we were in the rehab together. I was in there 9 months. I told you I'd run away. It was in Virginia, and my parents brought me back, and then she ran away. We weren't allowed to be near each other in there, in the rehab. That was the first time we'd ever been separated. We weren't allowed to talk to each other, look at each other.
That had to have been very, very hard.
Yes, yes. Very hard. And they called us druggy sisters. The place was called Street in Springfield, Virginia. And so we both ran away to the same place, Ocean City in Maryland, but at different times. It was just ironic, I guess, that we both ended up in the same place at different times. So I got brought back. She actually didn't. She actually stayed out of the rehab, but because she had turned 18 by that time, and she had, that's how, then she ended up in Baltimore with some friends. And so that's how she ended up there. And then when I got out, my parents sent me to a dude ranch in Wyoming to, well, they didn't like the boyfriend I was with. So because he was a staff member at the rehab and they thought he was a drug dealer and things like that. So that's a whole nother story. But
so wait a minute. Are we talking like City Slickers dude ranch or?
And Du Bois, Wyoming. It was great. It was a great experience being there. But my mom's family, a lot of her family had retired out there in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. So this was before we got, was big.
That's really big now.
Yeah. So I ended up in Wyoming and then Jody was in Baltimore and she had met her boyfriend there and he was a lot older than her. And she did not tell the truth about her age. She really liked him. And so he didn't find out for a couple years. he would joke about it. She was 21 for like 4 years, but she was, but she was a lot younger than he was, but they ended up moving in together. And that's the boyfriend that she was with when she died. And they both struggled with alcohol and it progressively got worse with the both of them. She was not doing drugs. Both of us suffered from really bad anxiety. So the alcohol definitely, even though, you know, people with anxiety think it's calming them, it definitely makes the anxiety worse. I don't know if you're aware about that.
No, but so I just want to clarify a little bit. So there were drugs earlier in life.
High school, yes.
So now Jody's...
And if you read the People article, it said she was a cocaine abuser or something like that. And that wasn't exactly accurate. Alcohol, I'd say, was our main drug. We got into other drugs, like I said, struggled with eating disorders, bulimia. So it wasn't, I didn't like the way that they put that in there. I don't know if you read that article, the People article.
I did, yes.
So that wasn't exactly, she wasn't a cocaine abuser. I mean, I would call it more just, it was like everything, you know what I mean? It wasn't just
occasional use back of that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I just want to make the clarification that there was drugs and alcohol early on, but basically we're now in her early 20s.
She's 23 right. At this point. Yeah.
Well, we haven't got there, but she, like you said, she was 21 and she's really just has a problem with alcohol.
Correct. At that point. Yes. And I knew, and I don't know at what point, you know, the doctor gave her Xanax for her anxiety. We both had medication for our anxiety. I suffered with severe panic attacks and she had similar attacks, you know, with the heart racing. And I mean, it's pretty, I think a lot of people talk about it, anxiety.
So was she taking the Xanax or Ativan kind of stuff and drank with it as well?
You know, probably. Okay. I don't know. It was later on that I knew about the Xanax. I don't know that that was like a long period, but I think the more you get into your addiction and the drinking, it's just sort of this vicious cycle and it just makes you more anxious, more than likely because her drinking progressed. So probably, yes.
So take us up to the point where she's 23.
Okay.
And she's living in Baltimore.
Correct.
Is she living in, now there are some rough parts of Baltimore, correct?
Yes. So she's living in Towson and on York Road, not a bad area where she was. I mean, it was actually, she was on the Baltimore County, Baltimore City line right there.
And she's attending Towson.
She's taking classes. She waitressed for a long time. And then the last few months she had got a job at Eastern Savings Bank, and that was above Towson. That's where she was working. And I'm not sure if that last semester, if she was taking any night classes, I'm not sure, but she was working at the bank those last couple of months. And the last time I saw her was the Christmas before that. I had come home and she had, you know, she spent a lot of time at this bar, the Mount Washington Tavern. When I would visit her, we would go to this bar. That was one of her favorite places to go. It's interesting. She was scared living in Baltimore. She was scared a lot. And she was actually scared of getting shot, which is just really hard to figure that out, why she was afraid.
So was that a combination of her anxiety and the fact that there were a lot of shootings in Baltimore, or what do you contribute?
You know, it's interesting because I tell different people that, and you know, the look on their face, like, wow, like, you know, was she afraid of somebody, something? It's hard to say, you know.
She never told you specifically why.
Yeah, I mean, could have been just that the circle of friends, her social network at that time maybe made her feel a little uneasy, maybe?
I don't know. I think it was more a combination of just being in Baltimore and her anxiety and that's possible. I mean, with me not being there, but I mean, it's possible. I mean, I think about this a lot. Was there things she was doing or think people, there's things that I didn't know about, you know, with me being so far away, things she didn't tell me.
Right. Because you see her last Christmas 95.
Yes.
Going into 96. And her murder's on March 2nd, 96. So it was 3 months, right? Since she, a couple months.
Yeah.
Two months.
Yeah, 2 months and a week, yeah.
So she was with her boyfriend, and they apparently had gotten into a fight that Thursday night. So it was Friday night that she had gone out. That was like the first, because she died, you know, into the hours of Saturday morning, but
early Saturday.
Yeah. Like 3:34. It was 3:41 in the morning. So that Thursday night, she and her boyfriend had gotten into a fight, and when they woke up the next morning, he told her not to come home that night.
Do we know what the fight was about?
I think it was about her drinking and going out to the bars. That's what I get from him. You know, even though he was drinking, you know, as much as she was, I think it was just her. Yeah, I think it was pretty much her drinking, you know, and I just think it was out of hand, their situation.
He finally just had enough.
Yes. Yeah. So she, well, I'll tell you what happened and then tell you everything she did that night was not with her anxiety and everything. It was not in her character to do what she did, but so she actually went to the bar that night, the Mount Washington Tavern, and stayed till close to closing time. There was Mount Washington Tavern is in Baltimore. There was also rumors that there was a possible thing going on with the owner of the bar, and he was interviewed early on. Actually, he wouldn't talk to the police early on. I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, but they threatened him with grand jury indictment because he wouldn't talk to the police, the owner.
So when you say a thing,
you mean romantic?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Okay. So that's hard to, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what was the talk, was sure. That there might've been something going on. He was married, and she actually, before she died in that parking lot, and I'll get to that, she made a couple of phone calls, and one was to him, looking for him at the bar. So that was one of the calls. So in my heart, I believe there's answers at that bar. People know something there, especially because I know of two specific phone calls that she made. There might have been one more, but they knew she was in this parking lot at the Mount Washington Tavern where she was. And it was, you know, a few minutes away. She was a minute from her house and a few minutes from the bar. So she was in the bar and she stayed till almost, not sure exactly what time she left, but it was close to closing time. And there was an employee there. I don't know how to say it. He was mentally handicapped. You know, he had some sort of handicaps. So he couldn't drive. And somebody had asked her to drive him home, but she never would have done that. It was snowing that night. Like I said, because she was afraid of everything. But so she ended up driving this employee home. And then she stopped at a liquor store that was open. So some sort of packaging store, and bought a six pack of beer, which leads you to believe maybe she was going to meet somebody.
Because, so I'm sorry to stop you, Jenny.
No, go ahead.
I just want to clarify. Your thought is she had no plans of going home because her boyfriend had kicked her out.
That's correct. That's correct.
I just want to make sure. I thought that was the case.
Right. And then she's been at the bar socializing, drinking. It's closing time. She leaves. She takes this individual that needed a ride home. Then she stops off at the packaging store or a convenience store is what we have around here, right? Yeah. Goes in, gets a six pack of beer, which I would think too that she's picking this up to take to go meet somebody. Right? I mean, I don't think. Well, I guess you would sit in your car and drink a six pack of beer.
Yeah, I guess the reason why I was heading down that path is because, you know, and maybe you already know, but where is she going?
Exactly.
What was her plan to stay? Where was she going to stay?
She had a plan because she would never, first of all, she wouldn't have even driven in the snow. Like she would have, that would have scared her too, to drive in the snow. It was snowing that night. And she would have had a plan. She wouldn't have had a plan of going to sit in the parking lot all night with her fears. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right. Like, she's not going to ride out the night in her car.
Yeah. So she gets a six pack of beer and probably starts, and I guess this is where you're headed, probably starts making phone calls to find out where she will be staying.
Or she's waiting for somebody and, you know, if it's something to do with the bar, she's calling the bar. And then she called, I'll explain the other phone call that I know about. Like I said, there might have been another one. But, she would not have had a plan of sleeping in a parking lot in the middle of the night. She had tons of friends. She would have made a plan to go to one of their houses. It just does not make any sense that she would just go aimlessly and not go anywhere. That's why that I think she knew somebody.
Okay.
So she goes. Yeah, go ahead.
So she left. She left the convenience store, the packaging store, with her beer, and then she just goes down the road, just a couple minutes, and then pulls into just an empty parking lot.
Yes, Caldor. It was formerly known as Cal. I don't know what kind of store it was, but right. It was called Caldor, and now it's the Drumcastle Shopping Center on York Road. Government buildings now.
Yeah. So it was whatever it was a closed business, right? They weren't open that late at night. And she just pulls into the parking lot to start making some phone calls.
That's correct. There's a, so when she's in the parking lot, there's a ATM with a camera there. And that's where they got one of the videos from there. Parallel to her is a 24-hour gas station. So there was, I believe it was a witness or two that heard the gunshot from that gas station. So across the road is a Boston Chicken Market. There's people there unloading the trucks, you know, even though it's the middle of the night. And then behind that is the Giant where she ended up. So she's sitting in this parking lot. The second call that she made, she had a friend of hers that lived with her for a long time. And she called her house and ended up talking to her boyfriend, which is an African-American male known maybe to be a drug dealer. And he worked at one of the restaurants there as a cook. So she had over 2.5 minute conversation with him, which is, you know, another interesting, what was that conversation about? Never talk to her friend, just talk to the boyfriend. He was talked to early on and they ruled him out because they said he didn't drive. He didn't drive. His girlfriend had a white car. You know, witnesses saw a white BMW is what they say, a BMW. So, you know, later on when I talked to the detectives about it, after he's been ruled out, they say, oh, well, we can't recall what kind of car he had. This is just one of their hundreds of contradictions where early on they say he didn't drive because he was ruled out. So,
yeah, I mean, I was going to ask, right? And I assumed you were going to get to it. So she's made these calls. The police obviously were able to get records of these calls. That's not a problem. And I assume that they talked to each of the people that she called.
I'm hoping so. I mean, I'm finding out
But that's part of the problem, right? And we're going to get into that. I don't want to get into it too early, but, you know, part of the problem in this case is, number one, how it was handled.
Correct.
By the Baltimore County Police. And we'll let you elaborate on that a little bit later. But let's get through the details of, and I know it's hard for you, even though it's been 21 years, it's probably not the easiest thing to talk about.
I'm just grateful for the opportunity to talk about it. And it still is very painful and just, you know, trying to figure out what happened. And so she's sitting in this parking lot and her window was rolled down. And that's why they think she knew this person. And what witnesses saw was her driving away and this person, I don't know if they saw the person shooting her. There's different things that was seen, but so shot her from behind. So it went in the back of her car on her side in through the door into the seat, into her spine.
Right. Through the back. I saw the picture through the back of her driver's seat.
Correct. Yes. Yes. And so she was able to drive. I think at that point she died pretty quickly, but she drove across York Road. So there's the Boston Market. She's pulling in. That's at the top of the parking lot. And he follows her and he stops at the top of the parking lot and she drives towards the Giant. It's a pretty big size parking lot. And he just watches her.
Now, is Giant a supermarket?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Because I thought that's what it was, but I wanted to confirm.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry that there are different stores.
No, but the reason why is because there are people there working third shift, right? At Giant.
Yes. And their cameras were down that night, which is incredible. Because that would have been, because that's where he watched her while she circled around the parking lot. And I think maybe she was probably just, like I said, she died pretty quickly. So she probably was just trying to survive and in shock. And so at some point she stops and he just drives up and parks right next to her and gets out of his car. And this is with witnesses around and they see him put her car in park. I guess she hit a curb or something. So her car wasn't in park, I guess, because that's what the detective said, that he put her car in park and reached in over her and took something out of her car. And then he was very slow. He got into his car and slowly drove out of the parking lot and took a right on York Road.
And was that something, her purse? Because I read something about that.
There's been different things that they've said. They think she had some sort of backpack. I don't think she had a purse. I think it was just a bag. So she didn't have her purse. I think, like I said, she had this bag, but there was nothing in her. Like the bag wasn't there. But they still say we don't know what he took out of the car.
But he didn't appear to be like in a big hurry.
No, right.
And also one thing, Jenny, I want to clarify: there was only one shot fired, correct?
Yes, yes.
And
that's correct.
So it went through the car. Mm-hmm. It went through the seat.
Yes.
And into Jody's spine. That's a lot to go through for one shot to kill somebody. It just happened to hit her, is what it sounds like. It happened to hit her in the spine.
Right. It sounds like she's at the packaging store, convenience store, gets her beer, goes to a couple minutes down the road, pulls over, starts making some phone calls. One of these phone calls is to her girlfriend's, but the boyfriend answers. We know the other one was probably to the bar. And then somehow somebody pulls into that parking lot where she's at, approaches the car. Yes. She rolls the window down, and you would do that most likely if you knew somebody. Especially,
well, it's cold.
Well,
we know it's cold,
and we know she's paranoid of conditions. Yes. And people's going to kill her. So she would really only roll that window down if she knew the person. Otherwise, she would just drove off.
Yes.
And obviously, she has the car ready to drive off. So someone approaches. For whatever reason, it sounds like she starts to drive away. That person shoots to try to stop her from driving away, hits her. Regardless, she has enough strength in her body to get the car across the street, pulls into the first place, the Boston Market, and then continues on into the Giant supermarket store parking lot. Car moves around a little bit. She eventually comes to a complete stop because she hits the curb. While this is happening, the person that shot her is watching from his vehicle, pulls up, gets in, reaches over, puts her car in park so it doesn't move anymore, and then takes
something,
some object out of her car, a purse, backpack, a packaging of something and gets in his car slowly, you know, not trying to get any more attention on himself, and drives off.
So Jenny, one thing I want to ask, what is it that we know for sure about this person? One, that they were driving a white car that appeared to be something like a BMW.
Yes.
Do we know the race? Were there witnesses?
Yeah, there were witnesses. African American male. They think maybe in his 30s. Yeah, there are fingerprints as well. Fingerprints, witnesses, videos. They said he had an army type fatigue jacket.
I did read that. Yeah. But those fingerprints to date have never matched anybody that's ever, at least what I read, right? They've never matched anybody that's been in the system.
That's correct.
Did they take the fingerprint at all of the girlfriend's boyfriend?
You know, you would wonder, you know, I don't know. If you were to ask me, probably not. It seems like they ruled him out pretty early on. You know, we found the fingerprinting kit in her car. When they gave us her car back, they'd left the fingerprinting kit in the car.
That seems pretty suspect.
Yeah, that's a little alarming, actually.
Yes. We found the kit, and they didn't even keep the car for very long. You would have thought they would have kept it.
And they ruled this person out solely based on the fact that it was known that he didn't drive.
That's what they told me. Yes. Right. Yes.
So I think a lot of the problem is that you're in the dark about a lot of what happened, because the police, either for whatever reason, because they can't, because it's an ongoing investigation, or they haven't shared a lot of the answers to some of these really burning questions.
Yes, but it actually hasn't been an ongoing investigation because they haven't really been working on her case. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, that's what I've found out over the years.
So
I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm very interested to get into that part. What else is there that we should know about? Because this is so different than Gibby than our other podcasts, right? We already knew the answers to what happened. This podcast, we don't know what happened. And part of what I was telling Jenny when we talked the other day is there's going to be a lot of people listening to this podcast, and there's going to be a lot of people that are from across the country. I mean, what are the chances? I don't know what they are. I'm hoping that, and I think Jenny is too, that there's somebody out there that knows something about this case that either they've been too afraid to date to come forward and talk about, or they're hearing something that triggers something in their memory that they either repressed or haven't thought about in such a long time. But it triggers it to say, oh my gosh, I may know something about this. And Jenny, at the end, we are going to tell everybody the different avenues that they can reach out and you know, contact. But that's what we're hoping happens. I mean, I want nothing more, and I know Jenny wants nothing more than to solve this case. So what other details do we need to give people about that morning of the 2nd?
There's several. I know there's two suspects. I don't know if you want, if that's, I'm trying to think about that morning. I think definitely if anybody is familiar with the Mount Washington Tavern, I just feel, I said that a little while ago, that, that I feel that there's people there that know something. Well, the owner said when I didn't talk to him for a long time. I knew him, didn't talk to him for a long time, years, because, you know, the police were, you know, questioning him and things like that. And so what he had told me, and this was hard for me to believe, is that his reason why she called the bar was she was looking for drugs. You know, that's that basically, she wasn't looking for him. She was looking for drugs. But what was known is that she was looking for him.
Well, because at this point, your understanding is that she wasn't into the drugs.
Correct.
She was into the alcohol, but she wasn't into the drugs. And I assume that's why you're saying you find it hard to believe.
Yes. That I mean, story. I'm not going to rule anything out. I mean, I certainly am not, you know, I'm open to anything. There's lots of theories about what happened.
Sure. So even if someone thinks that the theory is drug related, then fine. Then help us out, right? By who do you think that was? If you think that was somebody that was trying to steal the drugs out of her car or steal her purchase money for drugs out of her car.
Or who would have been the one that it, let's just indulge for a minute and go down that road and let's just say it was, right? Mm-hmm. Who would have been the person at that tavern that would have been the one that would have supplied it?
Yeah. Who would have benefited from her purchasing or benefited from her getting the drugs?
Right. Because let's be honest, right? We're not detectives. None of us. Jenny, you're not a detective. Mike and I are not detectives. We all have different types of jobs. But there's some things you know just by common sense. And I think number one is you look at who has the most to gain or who has something to gain by shooting Jody.
Thing about the bar real quick is though it was known for drugs back then, and I don't know how it is now, but if she wanted drugs, if she was there for 5 or 6 hours, why wouldn't she have gotten them? I mean, that's just 100% known fact. If she wanted drugs, why didn't she get them there? Like, I was told you could get them behind the bar, you know, from the bartender, you know, you could get them right there.
And she didn't leave and go to a bank, an ATM, and withdraw money to buy drugs, right? Because they would have found that on her banking records. So she didn't need to leave to go get funds to go back. Because why would she go get beer if she was going to do?
Well, no, I think it's a great point. She was at that bar for a long period of time.
Right.
If that was the intent to buy drugs at the bar, she would have bought them during the period of time that she was there. She wouldn't leave at 2 or 2:30 or whatever it was.
And go down the road a few minutes and then call back and say, hey,
yeah,
right.
Now I've just realized that I need drugs.
And if she was a regular drug user, they would have been in her system. There was no drugs in her system.
Well, that's true too.
And point. I think that's a very important statement that you make, because that goes against that theory to me.
Was the tavern owner married?
Yes. She said,
yes.
Okay. So it could have been his spinoff. Why did she call you, Mr. Tavern Owner? And his answer she was looking for drugs to
deflect.
Get the heat off of him of having the whatever fling was happening with him,
right.
if any, whatever was developing with them, to get that off of him.
When you have a case like this, there's so many different different theories or permutations that you can talk about. But I still think it goes back to a common sense approach of why does something happen? I mean, very rarely does it happen, I would think, randomly.
Well, I definitely think it's very
odd, but it can,
but the chances of someone pulling in that parking lot simply to rob her,
Knowing what she has.
Yeah. At that time of the night. And the fact that she rolled her window down, I just don't think it was a random crime.
And Jenny, I assume you would concur with all that.
Right. And that's sort of what the detectives let us down for years, you know, that it was a random shooting, you know, that would lead us, I'll get into suspect number one. But in my opinion, if somebody's going to rob somebody, I don't think they're going to maybe have a conversation with them and then decide to rob them. I mean, it seems like he would, if he was going to rob her, he might have come up and put the gun to her or something. You know what I mean? But going back to the window being rolled down, like, it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. As far as a random.
I agree, but I'm very interested to talk about suspect number one.
So This is somebody that they found maybe about 6 months after she died. So there was really nobody that they had for a while. There was somebody in a, I think it was some sort of auto body shop. And I don't know how he ended up coming to the police, but it was a African, they reported this African-American male with a white BMW. So they started looking at this suspect number one, and there was no, they sort of just said, we think it's him, you know, and he had a history of, he was married to a white woman. Basically he fit the description, and they kind of pinned it on him for a lot of years saying, we think it's him.
But obviously they couldn't prove it.
Right.
And they had no real hard evidence, or they would have moved forward.
Right. Like, he had some history of violence, you know, with white women, or, you know, I don't know exactly what, but.
Were they able to show a connection between him and her?
No, that's the thing. There was no connection whatsoever.
So he didn't hang out at that bar?
He did not, no.
And there was no connection from them ever dating or anything?
Correct. This is very interesting, though. So at some point, they had a prostitute that got brought in. And she said that she was with him, suspect number one, and he told her that he shot a white girl in the Caldor parking lot. This was at some point later on.
That's very specific.
Yes, yes, yes. But, you know, as time has gone on, I don't know if I believe that or with everything else that we've found out later on, or, you know, if the prostitute, I mean, it was a big thing that happened, that, you know what I mean? The murder in this area, there was nothing like that happens there. You know what I mean? What happened was, I'm trying to think of how many years later that this happened, that she, it was a lot of years later. So they were going to wiretap, this is what their plan was, the detectives, they were going to wiretap her, and they were going to put an ad in the paper about Jody's murder, hoping that, I guess, they'd get up and have coffee and read the paper and talk about the paper, right? So
this gentleman and the prostitute.
Correct. They were going to put an ad in the paper thinking they were going to pick up the paper and read the paper, and then he was going to talk about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. While she was wired, and he would say something to incriminate himself.
Right, right. So they never ended up doing that because he got arrested for threatening his wife. And they told me that they couldn't follow through on this because they had to lock him up. So they never did anything else to follow through at all. They never went in to talk to him. They never did anything. They never... And the detectives, and so I have a lot of messages with him. We communicated a lot through writing, and his response, so he told me, he said, yeah, we didn't follow through. I had to save one life, meaning the suspect's wife, save her life versus working on Jody's case.
So let me back up for a minute. And I know you may not know the answer to this, but obviously if he's in custody, they have his fingerprints.
Right.
And they could easily test his fingerprints against the fingerprints that were found in the car.
Yes.
So let's assume, and I know you're probably going to say don't assume when it comes to Baltimore County.
Right, right.
But me looking at it from the outside, I would assume they would. If they already had, they were going to wiretap, for crying out loud.
You think that'd be Detective 101.
Right. You take his fingerprints, which they would have as soon as they booked him. They probably already had him on file maybe anyway. Right. But
yeah,
they would take those, match them against the car, and they would either...
Confirm or...
Yeah, confirm.
Yeah.
Or just because they don't match doesn't mean he's...
Innocent.
100% excluded, but...
So they said they've run them through the system, but they just did the fingerprints again this year after me forcing them to do something on her case. So they probably, you know, I think they ran them hopefully early back, way back when, but then they ran them through again this year. But so he got locked up.
But yeah. all that means is that the person that left the fingerprints, which we're assuming is the same person that shot Jody, mm-hmm. has never been in the system.
we were talking about how they never, you know, they never followed through with him. And that was another thing over the years that I would say, you know, so he's been locked up off and on. He's locked up right now. And they kept, you know, I'd say, well, what can you do? Can you talk to him? And they'd say, yeah, we can go down. He's in the Lower Eastern Shore, which is near, close to me. I don't know how far from me, but some facility around here, but so not far from Baltimore. But so, they would tell me for like years, the main detective would say, you know, he could go talk to him, go in there and, you know, listen to jail talk, do things, but he would never do anything. Like, he kept saying he's going to go talk to him, he's going to do this. So it's just a one of many examples where they say, where they haven't been working on the case, where they, you know, they claim it's an ongoing investigation, but.
And Jenny, that's been your biggest frustration by far.
Yes. Cause there's leads not followed up on the contradicting information from the main detective. Like I said, I've stayed in touch with him over the years, and more so over the last couple of years, because, well, I mean, they've always said, you know, this suspect number one, you should be good now. He's locked up, you know, or whatever this high percent, 90, whatever percent we think it's him. Meanwhile, there's this other suspect and, you know, other things that have come out over the last couple of years that just started to make me think.
Well, that shocks me that anybody could say 90% when... Yeah. Unless you're holding something back that you haven't mentioned yet, there's been no evidence whatsoever that this guy actually did it.
Yeah, and his wife was the alibi. She did recant on her alibi. And when I asked the detective, I'll call him Detective B, I say about talking to her, and he says, oh, she doesn't like me. So that's the type of like talk that I get from him, like, because he had her fired from his job. So I'm thinking, well, the world doesn't revolve around you. Can't somebody else talk to her?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just so maddening.
Or that he doesn't want to do he can't do his job because he doesn't want to deal with her is basically what he's.
I get. Saying. But it's just typical with every communication that I've had with him.
Let's go to, because we are getting up against time. Let's go to suspect number two.
Okay. So I find out, so in the spring, on the 20-year anniversary, I get approached, and I've done news stories over the years, and, you know, we've kind of just gone with the fact, you know, we would go up there and talk with the detectives, and my dad was a prosecutor, so, you know, he was in touch with them. And I don't know if I told you that my father passed away from cancer.
Had both read it.
So that was really just devastating. And just, you know, and him not knowing what happened to her. And I mean, it's heartbreaking. I feel like I sort of have taken the lead for the family. It's very hard on my mother to think about all this.
So your mother is still alive.
She's still alive. Yeah. She's still in the same house that we grew up in. And so I'm the one that's sort of the family one that's been working with the detectives, and she's, you know, on the, you know, with me, but she just, it's just, she's been through a lot. And, sure. So I just feel like I'm strong enough now. And like I said, so on the 20 year anniversary, one of the news reporters, WBAL, David Collins, approached me about doing a news story, you know, bringing something out new in her case. So I approached the detective, B, and he said, well, we're not going to do that. We're not going to bring anything, you know, and it just infuriated me because, you know, this has actually been, and even over the last couple of years of them, of different things that they've been telling me they're going to do that they haven't followed up on. And you know, and me just being nice and, you know, okay, are you going to do this? Are you going to do, you know, and then when they didn't want to do this story, I went to the captain of his unit and threw a fit. And I said, you know what, you know, you got to do this. Like, it's a chance to get her case out, you know, again, in the public. And so they ended up doing it. And the detective was supposed to come to the interview. We went to the crime scene, you know, where she was shot. He never showed up. And the detective. And so I did the story. And at that point, I, you know, the other Baltimore news stations picked up the story. That's where I started doing the stories, and I just decided that I would start. I just started looking into things, like going back through all the messages from the detective and seeing that things weren't adding up and not making sense. And I started with the Mount Washington Tavern and called the owner. And when I called him, and I knew him, I mean, I knew he knew me, he knew my sister. He was investigated for a murder, and he acted like he didn't know me. He said, "I have to tell you, I didn't recognize your name." And I'm thinking, you don't get like investigated for a murder and not know, remember that, you know what I mean? Right. And so that was very odd to me. And he immediately wanted to tell me that Jody was doing drugs. And, you know, everybody likes to say that, oh, she was doing drugs. And I said, did you see her doing drugs? He said, oh, no, you know, and it's just, it's frustrating. And to tell me that there was no drugs in his bar. And
but he was cleared, I take it.
Yeah. I mean,
they had to have looked at him given the facts that have been laid out and the facts that I read and.
Right.
Given the fact that there may have been a relationship and that he was married and that she called him, he had to have been looked at. Now, we're assuming that the police did what they were supposed to do. Right. So we are making an assumption here.
So I find out from him, from some of his one of his bartenders, he said, well, you know, and I didn't say anything to him about suspects or anything like that. He said, you know, Jody was hanging out with suspect number two. And I'm like, what? Because, you know, he doesn't know what I know. Does that make sense? He doesn't know. Does that make sense?
Not yet.
Okay.
Try to bring it full circle. And I know.
Okay. So I know a lot from the police, right? I know who they're looking at and things like that.
Right.
And so when this owner tells me that he heard, but the police never told me that Jody was hanging out with suspect number two. They just said that he was a suspect. Does that make sense?
Okay. So you know who he is. And then
I know that he's somebody they're looking at.
Right. And then you find out from another person that she had been hanging out with him.
Right. Yep. And he says, my bartender told me about this. And he said, I would have thought it was a done deal with the cops, with the police, like that this, with this information. So my heart just like sunk. I'm thinking, what? Like I had never heard that Jody actually hung out with this person. And
Jenny, I assume that this person matches the description of the person that was seen at the crime.
Right. Okay. So I immediately get a hold of the main detective and he said, the police know about this. The police know that Jody was hanging out with him. So I immediately get a hold of the detective and he said, no, we've never heard that. So he's a suspect, but they'd never heard that Jody was at a house with him, was seen with him. And they told me like he was the second suspect because they said he didn't drive a white BMW. They said he drove a green BMW. So in all my research, if you see the Crime Watch video, he has a white BMW from what we've been told by one of the witnesses who confirmed that. And they lied to me about interviewing that witness that's hidden. He was never interviewed.
So time-wise, when did you find this information out?
In the spring.
Of just last year?
Yeah, just this last spring. Yeah.
So 20 years on, almost 20 years exactly, right? Because it'll be 21 March.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and I think that's one of the interesting things about what you're doing is that a lot of this, so a lot of stuff lay dormant for a long time,
right?
For long stretches of time.
Because we were told it's this one person and.
And you were also told that maybe some things were being done when they weren't. And now all of a sudden within the last year, you found out a lot more information
mm-hmm.
than you ever knew before.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Including suspect number two.
And they tell us that they didn't know any of these things that I have, that a lot of people know about, which is just so interesting. You know, people have told me that the police, that that the police know this, the people from the bar, that they've been told this information about Jody and this person. And they said they'd never heard it before. So it's just very interesting.
Yeah, so you're being told it's kind of common knowledge that suspect number two and your sister hung out.
Right.
Right, and that suspect number two drives a white BMW at that time. Right, and that
yes.
suspect number two fits the physical appearance of the shooter.
Right.
That sounds like a pretty big deal.
To me, it does.
Well, especially when the detectives are saying, what, they're not aware of that?
Yeah. And so lying about the witness. I mean, I have it in writing several times. I even asked the detective about suspect number two. I said, did you interview, you know, he's the main detective. He said, nothing's done on the case without him. And I said, did you interview suspect number two? His response is, I can't remember off the top of my head if I interviewed him.
Let me ask you this. This is Baltimore County.
Correct.
Tell me how Baltimore City PD has stepped into this case.
The chief of Baltimore City wrote me a handwritten letter, Baltimore City Police, and said that he, you know, was so touched to, you know, about Jody's story, because I did an article in the Baltimore Sun, so it was on the front page. And he said he wanted to, that his department is ready to assist in any way that they can. He had the major of his department call me, and they reached out to Baltimore County, and Baltimore County said, no, thank you, we don't need your help. Meanwhile, when I had a meeting with them in the spring, Baltimore County, they were telling me how overwhelmed they were with their cases and everything, but they don't need anybody else's help, is what they told Baltimore City. They reached out, Baltimore City reached out to them a couple of times. And well, I want to get back to that meeting in a minute, but yeah, so he wrote me the letter, and the last conversation that I had with the major of the department, he was asking about the one video where they say would show the suspect and the, I think, I don't know if we talked about this, you and I yet, the suspect and the, in his vehicle. They say they can enhance it. They can't, they said it would like solve, we could see it, but they said because of the snow and it's a VHS tape, they can't enhance it in their department. And the major from Baltimore City saying, well, have they sent it out to another agency? I said, no, I don't know why they won't send it out. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, that's, you know, that's what I'm saying. So 1996 technology versus 2017 technology, that's a big difference. In the world of video, that's a big span, right? In the way technology leaps forward, I have to believe that somebody, and maybe not Baltimore County, but somebody has the technology to
enhance it.
Yeah, he said, did they send it to Quantico? They sent it anywhere? I said, no. They're keeping it there.
Baltimore City wants to help, but they can't, right? I mean, they have no jurisdiction. They can only help if they're allowed to help.
Yeah, and they Baltimore County basically told them to butt out. And you know, and Baltimore City's got over 300 plus murders, you know, last year. And that was what, you know, some of the news people picked up the story when I got the letter, because they're thinking this is pretty incredible that, you know, he's got his hands full and he's reaching out to help in Baltimore County. Does that make sense?
Oh, like yeah. No, it's, yeah, it sounds yeah. amazing. It sounds like what you'd yeah. want your police captain to do, or I don't know if he said he was the captain.
The chief. Yeah, so the meeting is when I got really frustrated meeting with them. I just felt they, you know, it was the captain, the detective, the lieutenant. There was a few of them there. And I just felt that they were just not wanting me to be there, that's the feeling I got, not wanting to deal with me. And so when I was talking about for the, you know, maybe 20, maybe 50th time about going to talk to the suspect number one, you know, we were talking about the different, we had a list of things that they were going to do. And I said, when are you going to go talk to him? And he said, this is the detective, you know, well, I'll make my way down there. There's a great crab cake restaurant down there. That's what he's talking about, going to get crab cakes when he's going to, you know, work on my sister's murder. So that's like the kind of stuff that I get, you know. So we made a whole list of things that they were going to do. So the summer went by and I contacted them in October. yeah, it was, it, maybe it was in September, and started asking him about the different things that we talked about they were going to do, and nothing was done. They said, oh, we're, everything was pursuing. We're pursuing this, we're pursuing that, but nothing was done on the list of things. So it just goes on and on with them not following up. I mean, I understand that they have other cases. I get that. Right. But if there's obvious leads not followed up on, that makes sense.
Like, but no, I think it makes absolute sense, right? And I also understand that there's some things that the police can talk about and some things that they can't talk about. So is it possible that there's some things that they're doing that they can't tell you about? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I
mean, he always tells me, you know more than anybody. And no, I mean, it's pretty clear to me. I mean, it was pretty... the things that they should be doing, that they, we talked about doing. I mean, it's sort of the same thing, you know, going to talk to these guys. And
so, Jenny, let me ask you this, because I've had this question in my head for a while. Is this a cold case unit?
Yes.
Okay.
It is a cold case unit. Yes. Yes.
So it's what they're working on is cold cases.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
this is not a detective that's working a fresh
homicide.
And then the next day he needs to take a look at your sister's case, right? This is somebody Correct. That's only working cold cases.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's in the cold case unit. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just want to make that distinction because it, you know, I don't want people thinking out there that, you know, well, of course it's hard for them to get to it because they've got to solve all these other cases that have just occurred. I mean, this is a special cold case unit.
Yes.
That's
yes,
working on yes. a number of whatever that number is, a lot of cold cases. You know, I guess at this point, like we said, I'm just hopeful that there's somebody out there listening that either has known something for the past 21 years and has never come forward, or has heard something that has jogged their memory to the point where something clicked, right? Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yes.
And yes. So let's walk back just a little bit about what we know. Cause I mean, there's not a ton of information about the crime itself.
Right.
We know that the murder happened early morning, March 2nd, 1996. The suspect, by all witness indications, is an African-American male. Age range is what, 20 something to 30?
30s. Yeah, 30s. I was trying to
I saw a couple different things. Gib, yeah, what'd you have?
Yeah, the same thing.
20 something
to mid-20s and mid-30s.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah,
height wise, I saw anywhere 5'10, 6 foot, 6'1, 6'2,
weight around 220.
Yep.
Yes.
200, yes, 220. And then, like you already mentioned, the person that morning was wearing a green fatigue style coat. But, you know, other than, I mean, what am I missing as far as,
I mean, you're right about that. There's not a lot. I mean, there's, you know, there was the witnesses there. I mean, you pretty much got it all. We have the reward. I don't know. We haven't talked about that.
Right. You have a reward.
$32,000.
For information leading to an arrest, I assume?
Yes.
So you mentioned the witnesses. I assume that those folks are not going to come forward and all of a sudden realize something that they didn't already know. They probably said everything that they saw. I think this case is going to be solved by somebody that has heard, that didn't know at the time, maybe, but they've heard something in the last 20 years. I don't know if that makes sense to either one of you.
Yes. Relationships change.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. So buddies are really tight at this point in time and they have a falling out years later.
Yeah, so the loyalty's not there anymore.
Yeah, the loyalty's not there. And that person knows a secret that they would have taken to the grave had the situation with their friend or wife, girl, you know, girlfriend, whatever it is, had that situation not changed, that person would have no reason to say anything, but now maybe they do, or right. they have no reason not to come forward, other than the fact that they've known about it for a long time. And
yeah, because I don't think the person that did this would have kept it to themselves. I mean, from what you hear about these people, and probably you guys know, I mean, they talk.
I would say that's, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know.
It's very unlikely. People, I don't say in every case, but, you know, people get drunk and they tell a story, or they brag, right? There's all kinds of different reasons why people would commit a crime and then tell somebody else. Maybe they spent some time in lockup for something unrelated. I doubt that, though, because then their fingerprints would be in the system.
Yeah.
And you just said, Jenny, they ran them recently, right?
Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's only because I was on them about doing something about the case. You know what
right.
I mean?
But you
I
know,
mean, that, they, just, right. They did run it. Well, that's what they told me.
Okay. So let's say they did benefit of the doubt. So that means the person has never been in prison.
It's still at large.
Has never registered a firearm. Mm-hmm. Is not a teacher. I mean, just think about all the different ways, I mean, or reasons why you have to get fingerprinted nowadays. It's not just going to prison.
No, it's
or going to jail.
Job related in some fields.
Yeah, a lot of jobs now you have to get fingerprinted. When I went to get my concealed carry license, I had to
be fingerprinted.
And I guess it's possible that it's somebody else's fingerprints. Does that make sense? I guess.
No, it does, right? Because we've seen that before. Fingerprints could have been there before that day.
Not even be related to this, yes. Right? I mean.
Yeah. I don't know how long that they last. Yeah, I don't think we had a lot of people in and out of a car. I mean, so that's, you know, I mean, you're hoping that they checked the employee's fingerprints. You know what I mean? That they ruled those out.
I think that's the tough part about this case, not knowing or not being able to say what the police has done and who they've checked. Which
is why you want your hands on the files.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. Cause you know, we're running a little bit long here, but I want you to be able to talk about what you've been up against with this file.
Okay. Request. So I filed this summer from, you know, I didn't know that I could do, I didn't know I had an option to do anything. I mean, I just waiting for them, and this spring getting so frustrated and just sort of having this awakening, like, oh my gosh, like this just, things aren't right here. You know, looking back at all the information that I have and thinking, you know, and finding out, seeing the contradictions and the work not being done and the lying to me about this witness. And I'm thinking, what else is wrong here? You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's when I was told by a reporter I could file this MPIA request for her file. And they denied. So I hired a lawyer and filed for that. And they denied that. They sent a letter to my lawyer citing cases that had nothing to do with the murder, but has nothing. They cited like a burglary and something about a prostitute, some crazy situation that had nothing to do with our case. So they denied the MPIA request. So we went ahead and filed suit for the file. 30 days went by. They waited till the 30th day. The Baltimore County Police, and they came back and said they're hung up in technicalities. They said, you can't sue us. We're not a legal entity. They said, you have to sue the county. So which is technically not true, but my lawyer did it anyway, just amended the suit and filed, added the county to the suit. And I've met with the lawyer and we've talked about, we decided to put together a letter now that we have leverage right now, you know, with the news people. I've done a lot of stories that one of the concerns with getting the case file is them. They don't want to set precedents for other families. getting the case file. Does that make sense? So we put together a letter saying, look, can we talk about getting the file, you know, trying to negotiate with them. Can we get the file outside of court? And he also sent a letter to the judge, you know, as far as with the depositions. And this was in December. We've heard nothing. They haven't responded. They've ignored my lawyer. The judge has not responded as well. He has since, just over about a week and a half ago, sent the deposition notice, the deposition interrogatories. So we'll be going forward with that. You know, it's not something, you know, it took me a lot of time this summer to really think about moving forward with this lawsuit. I didn't want to do this, to file the suit. I didn't want to cause this big battle. But I felt I just got to the point where I thought, you know, I what do I have to lose? You know, they're not doing anything now. They haven't been. So I decided, you know, to move forward with it. But, you know, at this point.
No, I was just going to say, so Gibby, if she gets the file, does that then lead us into a whole like serial style podcast? Because we've got all this information.
Yeah. I mean, in the file. I think to open that, get the follow up through that.
That would be very interesting.
Yeah, it's critical.
Because, you know, obviously we're spending an hour and a half here or whatever it is talking about, in broad strokes, your sister's case. And we're trying to get out as much information. But there's so much information in that file that if you had that, you would have tons of
think it's so
material
simple
to work with.
If they just share the file with Baltimore City, I think that puts a lot of calm in for Jenny, because she'll know that another set of eyes opened it up and looked at it. And
yeah, but you see that so often. You see agencies, and I'm not sure what the reason is. Obviously, I've never been in law enforcement, but not wanting to work with or allow other agencies to come in and kind of be a part. I mean, you see that happen all the time.
Right.
I don't know exactly what the reason is.
Yeah, but share the file, you know, share the file with the with the private investigator. What can it hurt?
I agree. But so, I mean, I guess, you know, Jenny, that's still ongoing, right?
The lawsuit?
Yeah.
So they sent my lawyer sent the deposition notice for March 2nd.
So you'll actually
the depositions on the anniversary. Yeah. Which I thought was.
So the deposition will be able to tell you a lot.
Right. But I mean, I'm concerned. He said, don't be surprised if they ask for a protective order, meaning, I guess they'll try not to give much information. Or try not to. Yeah, I mean, they're like stonewalling me every which way they can, just to try to get the information.
And they've got the county attorney on their side, right?
Oh, sure.
That doesn't cost, you know, it's taxpayer money, but
their countersuit or their response, they're asking me to pay they're saying they want me to pay their lawyer's fees,
right? As part of the countersuit. And we're going to talk about, you know, your GoFundMe page here in a little bit as a way to maybe for anybody that wants to go out and look and reach out and help in this fight against the county. Right. Jenny, like I said, we've given out all the information about the case. You've talked about some suspects. I really think it's up to hopefully somebody that is listening and either get the courage to come forward or recognize that they've known something that they didn't really put it together until now. And like I said, we're not talking about Maryland. Maybe this could be somebody in another state that heard something from somebody's cousin 5 years ago.
Right.
I mean, there's just no telling where this information could come from. So Jenny, if somebody does have information, what do they do? How do they get it to the right place?
so they can, there's two different ways. I mean, there's the Metro Crime Stoppers hotline, and that's available 24 hours a day. And that's 1-866-7-LOCKUP or 1-866-756-2587. That's the reward. You know, we have the $32,000 reward. And, you know, they can also call the Baltimore County Police Department. I don't have their number right in front of me, but I can get that.
I'm sure anybody can Google that. So
Baltimore County Police Department.
Yeah. So the other thing I wanted you to talk about was your GoFundMe page. Like you said, it's not an inexpensive thing to take on a county or a police department in the type of fight that you're up against. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I know you have a GoFundMe page. Tell people how they can go check that out.
Oh, that's great. I appreciate that. Yes. It's GoFundMe, and it's Jody LeCornu, LeCornu. That's what we have it under. It's just GoFundMe, Jody.
It's easy to find. While we were doing the podcast, Gibby, you know, I went out there, found it really easy, contributed. I find it. So if I can do it, you know, if you're out there,
not paying attention to the podcast,
I am. I am. But if you're out there, you know, if you want to do it, you're welcome.
Yeah.
If you want to do it, it's really easy to do.
Yeah. I found it last night and contributed. So obviously we knew we were doing this show with you, but that's not the reason why we contributed. Spending time with you ahead of the show and getting to know you a little bit. I think we both feel like we're invested in this now.
Absolutely.
And I can see where, you know, Jenny, we're probably going to want to stay in touch and hear how things are going.
Definitely.
You know, we could even do an update episode, even if it's just a small update, or if there's something that you want to get out to the listeners. You know, we have ways to do that. So I can't tell you how much we appreciate you being the first guest.
Oh my gosh, no, it's been fantastic. Oh my gosh, yeah, it's been great. And, I'm just talking to you guys. I hope we can move forward and do a. We get the case, and I like your idea about that. I think that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, hopefully we do a follow-up where we say the case is now closed.
Oh, yeah, we'd like that.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. No, this has been such a great experience for me, really. You guys have made it so easy. And
yeah, it's been awesome for our first one, and we appreciate it, and we wish you all the best, and we'll stay in touch. I know we're connected on social media, so definitely as things break, and we'll check in with you every now and then, okay?
Oh, that's wonderful. Right. Okay.
Well,
okay.
Thanks again. And you have a great night.
All right. You too. Take care, Gibby. Appreciate your guys' help and everything.
Thank you, Jenny.
All right. Bye-bye. All right.
Bye.
All right. Like I said, we really appreciate Jenny for coming on. You know, it's a sad story, Gibby.
Absolutely.
And different from any other podcast that we've done before. She did the majority of the talking, and
yeah,
we wanted her to be able to get her story out there. And, you know, like I said, it would be amazing if somehow this podcast was able to reach somebody that knew something, and that led to solving this 21-year-old case.
Yeah. If it's somebody, like you said, coming forward with any bit of information, if it's somebody coming forward that can help her to figure out how to get her hands on this file so they can open it back up and maybe get, you know, closure that way.
And I said something during the episode where somebody might not want to come forward after all this time because they've known for X amount. There's so many ways to get your information anonymously.
Sure it is. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there is.
And most of that Crime Stopper
is anonymous.
Yeah. So yes. They're just wanting you to call and you leave whatever, no matter how silly, small.
They don't care.
They don't care. Leave it. And then they'll be able to look at it and figure out, you know, what they can do with it.
Right. That's the first episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved in the bag. Gibby, we got a lot more in us.
We do.
All right. Well, everybody, stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.